everyone who loves books. This is Read On Air on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On Air, the show all about books that belongs to you. I'm your host, Red Sale, and today, Jessica Fox tells us how she quit NASA to work in a bookshop and ended up writing Three Things You Need to Know About Rockets.
I began having visions of working in a bookshop by the sea in Scotland.
Robert explores the close links between Star Wars and talking books.
You won't like what I'm going to ask you to do, I said. Anything, sir, anything. Well, I said, do you think you could promise never to see Star Wars again?
The Connect book group considers whether Eleanor Oliphant is completely fine.
He was there when she hit rock bottom, really, wasn't he?
That must have been a very
testing of friendship, that must have been.
And author David Mitchell takes me to a creepy supernatural mansion and reveals that his characters write to him.
But, as you say, once every 9 years, if things have aligned right, then you'll find a small black iron door down there.
That's all coming up on today's Read On Air. Now, as you may remember, Sean Byfull runs The Bookshop in Wigtown. His Diary of a Bookseller lifts the lid on the trials and tribulations of his worthy profession, and it's flying off the shelves. We promised to bring you a clip as soon as the audiobook became available. So, true to our word, here it is.
Orwell's reluctance to commit to bookselling is understandable. There is a stereotype of the impatient, intolerant, antisocial proprietor, played so perfectly by Dylan Moran in Black Books, that it seems, on the whole, to be true. There are exceptions, of course, and many booksellers do not conform to this type. Sadly, I do. It was not always thus, though, and before buying the shop, I recall being quite amenable and friendly. The constant barrage of dull questions, the parlous finances of the business, the incessant arguments with staff and the unending, exhausting, haggling customers have reduced me to this. Would I change any of it? No. When I first saw the bookshop in Wigtown, I was 18 years old, back in my hometown and about to leave for university. I clearly remember walking past it with a friend and commenting that I was quite certain that it would be closed within the year. 12 years later, while visiting my parents at Christmas time, I called in to see if they had a copy of Three Fevers in stock by Leo Walmsley, and while I was talking to the owner, admitted to him that I was struggling to find a job I enjoyed. He suggested that I buy his shop, since he was keen to retire. When I told him that I didn't have any money, he replied, "You don't need money. What do you think banks are for?"
A clip from The Diary of a Bookseller by Sean Byfull, read by Robin Lang, and now available commercially. Sean's partner at the bookshop for several years was Jessica Fox, herself a published author. In an office above the shop, she told me her unique story.
The book is a memoir, and it begins with when I worked for NASA at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, right near Pasadena, California, and I began having visions of working in a bookshop by the sea in Scotland. And at the time, I was working for NASA in the daytime, and then I'd be making my films in the nighttime. So I thought, oh, maybe this is a nice rom-com that I'm going to write. So I sat down to write it, and I started getting more irritated that all the characters that I was writing about were having amazing adventures. And here I was in the heat of Los Angeles sitting in one room just staring at a screen. So I thought, you know, this is an adventure I want to have. And the more I sort of delved into the vision of it, the more I could see myself behind the long wooden counter, and I could see that outside it was raining, and I could just feel it was Scotland, and I was surrounded by books, and I was in a big woolly jumper drinking tea and just very content. So I go on to type in used bookshop into Google, and Wigtown comes up, and Wigtown's Scotland's national book town. And it said it had 16 bookshops and about 900 people right by the sea. And there is a hubris to dreaming, because this vision was so strong, I thought one of them is going to take me in as a live-work holiday. So I type in, the first bookshop on the list was called The Bookshop. So I type an email out, and I try to sound as normal as possible, and I don't talk about the vision at all. And then within three correspondences, I had booked my ticket, and I was coming over to Scotland. And I had assumed that the bookshop owner was sort of elderly and in his probably 80s and surrounded by grandchildren who were helping him with these emails, because his emails were quite short and sweet. But when I got there, I realized the bookshop owner was kind of a disheveled, very charming, very smart, and really lovely man. He was much younger than 80. And I ended up falling in love with the town and him and staying. So that's sort of what the book is about and the adventures that ensued.
That's a wonderful story. What did your friends and family say?
Speechless may have been. My mom, when I first came over, just for kind of the holiday, she looked at me quite sternly and said, "Don't fall in love with anyone." So she must have also had a premonition that that would have happened. I think people were quite shocked, but they also, the more we started chatting about it with my friends, the more I realized that they kind of harbored dreams. One wanted to work in a flower shop in Amsterdam. There were all these parallel lives that kind of people were fantasizing about but not acting on. It led to some really interesting conversations.
And you're still here, which means that the love affair with the Scottish book town has still continued.
Yeah, the love affair with the Scottish book town has continued. Unfortunately, the bookshop owner and I lasted a very long time, but didn't work out. We're still very, very good friends. But what it did was definitely reorient my ship towards Scotland and staying here. And I absolutely love living in the UK. I love making films here. I love writing here. And my relationship with Wigtown has continued and deepened. So it's been lovely.
And is there going to be a film of three things you know need to know about rockets?
Do you know, there may be. So Sean has just written a book, Diary of a Bookseller, and we're actually combining our books because he talks about the day-to-day life of running a bookshop. I have kind of the very American romantic vision of falling in love with a Scotsman in the sea and have more of a narrative. So we're actually combining our books and working with a producer to maybe hopefully make a TV show.
And for visually impaired audience members, is there an audiobook?
There isn't an audiobook, and I'd absolutely love if there was one. So if anyone who's a good reader wants to volunteer, I will happily work with them. I'm a bit dyslexic, so it's very hard for me to read my own work aloud. So I would absolutely love teaming up with someone who would want to do an audiobook for me.
Now, I also happen to know that another thing that you and Sean worked on together was destructive testing of Kindles. Could you tell me a bit more about that?
Yeah, trying to channel Sean's rage at the, and the Kindles. Sure. You know, it was really began with Sean's... We were watching a lot of YouTube videos. We started a company called Picto Productions, where we'd make a lot of films in the area. Sean had interest in documentary a while back before starting the bookshop, and I was a filmmaker, so together it's just sort of we made lots of fun videos about the shop, and it was Sean's idea to shoot a Kindle. I think he just really wanted to, so we started thinking about ways to destroy Kindles, and that was quite good fun.
And obviously, being a filmmaker, you must have to consider those people who might not be able to see the film. Have you worked with audio description at all?
You know, we have. I've worked with audio description in the past when I worked with NASA, because we made different videos for them, and the sound design. There is I'd like to shout out to one of my favorite artists who's a storyteller. So when I was working at NASA, instead of videos, we decided to hire a man named Jay O'Callaghan, who's one of the last remaining oral storytellers. And he is very visual, but he describes the images that he sees. And so he lived within NASA for about a year and created a story for NASA that is all audio. So I have a real passion and interest for storytelling, and it tends usually not to be on the screen.
And I know that there's quite a bit of research going into the audio version of virtual reality being done at NASA as well.
Yes, that's exactly right. I think for a scientific organization, I would really love to tell people that it is probably one of the most creative powerhouses near Los Angeles, and that includes the film industry. I think NASA is on the cutting edge of entertainment and inclusion, and also figuring out really innovative solutions to a lot of problems, not just in science.
Jessica Fox, thank you so much for joining us on Read On Air.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
Thanks to Jessica Fox. And let's hope that Three Things You Need to Know About Rockets finds a narrator soon.
RNIB. Supporting people with sight loss.
The RNIB News Agent Service, which delivers the latest news, magazines and stories in a range of accessible formats to people with sight loss, is now free for under 16s. Reading can make the world of difference, and it's vital that all blind and partially sighted children can access the same content as their sighted peers in a fun and creative way. Current titles in the RNIB newsagent service include BBC Horrible Histories, First News, Aquila, National Geographic, and RNIB Blast Off. Formats include audio CD or USB, email or Braille. To register for RNIB newsagent, please call our helpline on 0303 123 9999 or email us at helpline@rnib.org.uk.
The Moth.
I'm Jay Ellison. Join us for more true personal stories told live on stage. No scripts, no notes, no nothing. Each Moth Radio Hour is a mix of funny and heartbreaking tales that captivate and surprise and delight audiences around the world with their honesty and bravery and humor. That's the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
Wednesdays from 8 p.m. and Sundays at 11 a.m. on RNIB Connect Radio.
This is an RNIB talking book.
My dad, bless him, is losing his sight quite rapidly at the moment. He's got macular degeneration and is registered blind now.
Author Jonathan Mears on supporting talking books.
And I know that he is becoming increasingly dependent on talking books. He cannot speak highly enough of the RNIB and everything they do, and they've been an absolute godsend to my own dad.
For more information on the Talking Book service, head to www.rnib.org.uk or call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999.
You're listening to Read On Air on RNIB Connect Radio, your one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. Still to come on today's show, the two voices of Obi-Wan Kenobi, alive and well in the RNIB library. And David Mitchell discusses Cloud Atlas and his latest novel, Slade House. But before that, someone else that I met at the Wigtown Book Festival was Gail Honeyman. Her debut novel, Eleanor Oliphant Is Completely Fine, has been this year's publishing sensation. We'll find out what the RNIB book group made of it later. But first, here's Gail to share a few insights.
It was Wednesday evening, mummy time. However much I might wish it were otherwise, she always managed to get through to me in the end. I sighed and turned off the radio, knowing I would have to wait until Sunday's omnibus now to find out whether Eddie Grundy's cider had fermented successfully. I felt a flash of desperate optimism. What if I didn't have to talk to her? What if I could talk to someone else, anyone else? Hello, I said.
Oh, hiya, hen, it's just me. Some weather the day.
So, Gail, I was struck by the difference in language between the rather Jane Eyre voice that Eleanor has and the modern Twitter speak that is in the book. It's a wonderful contrast between old and new.
Thanks very much. Yes, the musician character, he largely is in the book through the medium of tweets, and I quite enjoyed the brevity of trying to convey that character and the plot points that needed to come across through the medium of his tweets, yeah.
And without giving too much away, I did think he was really the only very negative male character in the book. There's a wonderful warmth for humanity that flows through the pages of the book.
Yeah, I think I wanted to show the importance of kindness in the book, and most of the characters display that in some way and or are grateful to be recipients of it in some way, and that was a theme that I really wanted to try and highlight in the book.
And those small acts of random kindness can have very beneficial effects for the characters within the book.
Yeah, I think very small acts of kindness, you know, the tiniest thing, if they happen at the right time for the right person, can be completely transformative. And I was trying to show that in the novel, that both for the person who performs the act and for the person who's the recipient of the act, they can be transformative and very, very positive things to experience.
And Eleanor starts the book almost behind a self-imposed wall of awkwardness, which attracts sideways glances and comments from her co-workers and from other people, and develops through the book and comes maybe out from behind that wall. It's a fascinating study in how a character can build themselves.
I guess I wanted to show, yes, as you say, that Eleanor is largely the agent of her own transformation, albeit she is helped and supported along the way by the people that she encounters. But, yeah, I wanted her to have the agency to make that transformation supported by kind people rather than be saved as, you know, she's the active participant there, yeah.
Yeah, she's neither self-pitying nor reliant on other people.
No, but there's a learn, without wanting to give too much away, she learns that you have to open yourself up to other people, or that it's a positive thing to open yourself up to other people. You risk getting hurt that way, but also you allow so many other positive, beneficial, enjoyable experiences too, and that's part of what she has to learn, that character has to learn on that journey that she takes.
And she bears both mental and physical scars, very obvious physical scars, which do attract comment. I think a lot of disabled people would find that very resonant with the way that we find comments are sometimes directed at us. And yet she never lets it dictate her interaction with other people, does she?
No, I don't think she does. She's aware of other people's reaction to her, but it isn't at the forefront of her mind. I think it's only other people's reactions to her that give her pause for thought, if that makes sense.
And she's a beautiful person despite the scar. Yes, during the book she does become more presentable, but actually she's a very warm person, isn't she?
She is. She keeps it quite well hidden at the start of the novel. There's a complex person inside there that I think, because of how she presents herself at the start of the novel, maybe most people in a superficial interaction with her don't necessarily see and aren't aware of. And we as readers, because it's written in the first person, we have the luxury of being able to see who Eleanor really is. Most people that she encounters don't, and many of them don't take the time to find out. Also, maybe she doesn't necessarily encourage them to find out through some of her behaviour at the start of the novel. Yeah, so I guess it's about learning to interact on a deeper level with people.
It's a brilliant audiobook. Did you have much to do with the choosing of the narrator?
I had nothing to do with the choosing of the narrator, and I couldn't be happier with Kathleen McCarran's narration. I can't tell you the number of people who've told me that they've loved it. And so people that listen to exclusively to audiobooks who definitely know what they're talking about have said, you know, just given such positive feedback. And I think she's done an absolutely wonderful job with it. I couldn't be happier with her as narrator.
She feels like she's reading it to the listener personally. It's a rare trick.
I don't tend to listen to audiobooks very much myself, so I trust the judgment of people who listen to them a lot, and I'm so delighted with the response that it's got. And when I listened to it, I just loved it, and I thought she's done a fantastic job.
Brilliant. And just finally, I know you're working on a new book, and I know you don't want to give too much away, but are you still finding the same discipline to get up and write every morning, even though you don't actually have to go to the day job that you used to have to go to before you got published?
Well, yeah, this is my new day job. So, yes, I am. I mean, writing is... it's just something that you feel compelled to do. So I'm really enjoying working on the new book, and I hope people will like it when it's ready to come out. I'm not sure when that will be yet, but it's I loved writing Eleanor, and I loved writing that voice. I'm really enjoying now working with new voices. So yeah, watch this space, I guess.
Gail Honeyman, thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me. It's been a complete pleasure.
Thanks to Gail Honeyman, who'll be back at the end of the show to share the books of her life.
But now, let's hear what the RNIB Connect book group made of Eleanor Oliphant.
Does anybody know anybody that's like Eleanor Oliphant's character? I know Supriya said that she did, but is there anybody... And also, are there any books that you can sort of compare it to? You know, are there any other heroines that you can sort of compare her to?
Gosh, no, I've never come across anybody like her.
Can't really think of anybody of any other book. I mean, that was one of the charms of it, that it was quite unusual, quite different. And as I said earlier, the insight into character was one of the charms of it. Mm-hmm. And I liked it because it was set in Glasgow. I mean, I used to do occasional voluntary work for the Glasgow Centre for Sensory Impairment, and that was in Partick, and that was quite near the Western Infirmary. So I could see where she was talking about.
It's right. Interesting, that kind of misfit-type character. I have come across one or two of them over the years in books. The most, the one that I remember most is a character called Cyril Frewin in John le Carré's The Secret Pilgrim.
Uh-huh.
His case ended in complete tragedy and he ended up going mad in the end, really. But he was that kind of misfit. His interests weren't everybody else's interests. He was mocked and vilified in the office. And it's amazing the effect that it had on him. He actually ended up becoming a spy. But Eleanor Oliphant did actually remind me of Frewin a bit in her sort of, like I was saying earlier on, in her singleness, in her, you know, there seemed to be an area around her that nobody was going to be able to penetrate. And with this Cyril Frewin character, that remained the case forever. Whereas with Eleanor Oliphant, at least she did find Raymond, which was something at least.
It was interesting how nasty, not deliberately nasty, but how the people didn't understand because, well, obviously we didn't know her background at that point, but they weren't very kind about her scars and things, you know, sort of looking at her sideways and things.
I think in an office environment, there's always a sort of hierarchy, isn't there?
Mm.
There are cliques.
Yeah.
And if you don't belong to a clique, it's very, very difficult.
And the thing is that if you don't, it's a thing that I think in any, it's kind of, there's a need to prove yourself, isn't there?
Did you
find Raymond a character that you understood?
Yeah, I could see.
It's quite straightforward. There's nothing complicated about him, is there?
No.
He's a kind-hearted gentleman, I thought.
Yes, and he's, and taking her to see his mother and everything, he was also kind.
Yeah. Mm.
You could see how... From that, how his background, how his character had developed so different from her unfortunate background with all her foster homes and things.
And he was there when she hit rock bottom, really, wasn't he?
Mm.
Yeah.
That must have been a very testing of friendship, that must have been.
He was basically a good person, wasn't he?
Just the kind of conversation that makes joining a book group so worthwhile. Eleanor Oliphant is completely fine, is TB701915. And if you'd like to get involved in the RNIB Connect book group or get advice on setting up your own book group, then here's how.
RNIB. Supporting people with sight loss.
Would you like to chat over the telephone with a group of like-minded people? RNIB's award-winning telephone social groups are small, friendly and lots of fun. A great way of making new friends and a chance to socialise without leaving the comfort of your home. Telephone RNIB Talk and Support on 0845 330 3723 or email talkandsupport@rnib.org.uk.
It may shock many people to know that in the UK, another 100 people start to lose their sight every day. Now, sight loss can happen to anyone at any time, and the RNIB is there to provide support when it does happen.
Frederick Forsyth
on supporting Talking Books.
Talking Books is described as one of the RNIB's most important services. To find out more about Talking Books or to support the RNIB campaign, call 0845 345 0054 or visit www.rnib.org.uk.
You're listening to Read On Air on RNIB Connect Radio. Still to come, David Mitchell leads us up the garden path to a very creepy mansion. But before that, with adverts for the film The Last Jedi popping up everywhere, Robert Kirkwood felt forced to investigate the close links between Star Wars and RNIB Talking Books.
There has been an awakening. Have you felt it?
The Talking Book Service from RNIB has approximately 350 professional narrators, and currently, amongst that number, is an X-Wing pilot, a Star Destroyer commander, a junk dealer from the planet Tatooine, and even an Ewok. In the library, you'll also find books written by Jedis and read by droids, and one regular narrator from back in the day once commanded the first Death Star. One of those Jedi was Obi-Wan Kenobi, played by Alec Guinness. RNIB Library has the book Dear Alec, Guinness at 75, and the autobiographies Blessings in Disguise, My Name Escapes Me, and A Positively Final Appearance. Those Star Wars fans, beware. Alec Guinness does not share your love.
A refurbished Star Wars is on somewhere or everywhere. I have no intention of revisiting any galaxy. I shrivel inside each time it is mentioned. 20 years ago, when the film was first shown, it had a freshness, also a sense of moral good and fun. Then I began to be uneasy at the influence it might be having. The bad penny first dropped in San Francisco, when a sweet-faced boy of 12 told me proudly that he had seen Star Wars over 100 times. His elegant mother nodded with approval. Looking into the boy's eyes, I thought I detected little star shells of madness beginning to form, and I guessed that one day they would explode. "I would love you to do something for me," I said. "Anything, anything," the boy said rapturously. "You won't like what I'm going to ask you to do," I said. "Anything, sir, anything." "Well," I said, "do you think you could promise never to see Star Wars again?" He burst into tears. His mother drew herself up to an immense height. "What a dreadful thing to say to a child," she barked, and dragged the poor kid away. Maybe she was right, but I just hope the lad, now in his 30s, is not living in a fantasy world of second-hand childish banalities. A couple of weeks ago, in a Chinese restaurant, the dapper little Chinese maitre d' bowed low as I left, and full of Chinese smiles said, "Sir Gin, now that Star Wars is being shown again, you will be famous once more." Oh, to be Ernest Thesiger.
The second person to play Obi-Wan was Ewan McGregor, who also makes an appearance in the Talking Books library with his book The Long Way Round.
Every journey begins with a single step. In our case, it was 8 years ago when Charlie walked up to me in Casey's, a pub that was more like someone's living room than a bar, at Six Mile Bridge in County Clare. Except for an eager and winning smile, there was nothing in the way of an introduction. "You ride bikes," he said. "Yeah," I replied hesitantly, taken aback by the gregarious, long-haired stranger in front of me. With our wives and daughters, we had moved into cottages on location in Ireland to shoot Serpent's Kiss, a movie I will always remember fondly for the many long nights of drinking, partying and discussing bikes. It was the kick-off party on the eve of the first day's shooting, and although Charlie and I didn't know it yet, we had a lot in common. We were both married with daughters only a few months old. We'd both been successful actors for some time, and we were facing weeks of working closely together. There was a lot we could have talked about, but Charlie had an instinct for cutting through social niceties straight to the subject closest to a person's heart. This time was no exception. Charlie's in-your-face affability had got the better of my reserve. Yeah, I ride a 78 Moto Guzzi, I said, referring to my first big bike, a heavy Italian machine built like a tractor. And with that, we were away. The evening dissolved into a long night of biker anecdotes and bonding over tales of fatherhood.
In this book, fellow film actors and bike enthusiasts Ewan McGregor and Charlie Boorman travel 20,000 miles around the world by motorbike. They will encounter many troublesome situations along the way, ranging from extreme and threatening weather to impenetrable terrain, and will face challenges such as caviar fishing in the Caspian Sea, wrestling with the Mongolian Olympic team, and riding with the Canadian Mounties whilst throwing themselves enthusiastically into the culture of each new country.
One afternoon, I got a phone call from Rick McCallum, the producer, and George Lucas's right-hand man. He wanted to speak to me about the bike. My first thought was, I'm in trouble. I guessed I'd taken out too much money, as if the Star Wars producers didn't have that much cash. But guilt is always the first response, and I thought I had done something wrong. I went up to the producer's office, knocked on the door and walked in. Rick was waiting.
George and I want to know how much this bike is costing you, he said.
I told him how much, thinking I was about to be castigated for bothering the production accountants.
George and I would like to buy it for you, Rick said.
I was stunned. For the next few years, I rode around on what was, in effect, George Lucas's bike, until I passed it on to Charlie, who rides it to this day. It was quite ironic that George Lucas bought me the Ducati. My contract usually forbids me from riding a bike while shooting a movie. The only location where I was allowed to ride to work was Australia. I spent almost 2 years there on and off shooting Moulin Rouge and the second and third Star Wars episodes. Working in America, where I had to take the company limousine or drive by car to the studio, had driven me nuts. So when I first met Baz Luhrmann, the director of Moulin Rouge, I told him that if he wanted me to sign up for 8 months to rehearse and shoot his film, a much longer period than the usual 3 months a film takes, I had to be allowed to ride a bike. I act, I am with my wife and kids, and I ride motorbikes. That's it. That's all I do, I said.
Peter Kenny reading the words of Ewan McGregor with Charlie Boorman in the book The Long Way Round. One of the many books in the Talking Books library with a connection to the Star Wars saga. The Talking Book service is now free and easier than ever to join. For more information, head to rnib.org.uk.
Chewie, we're home.
Thanks, Robert. May the Force be with you. Do you have a book that you think would expand my reading horizons? Or maybe you found a hidden gem in the library that you'd like to share with us? Drop us a line by emailing readonair@rnib.org.uk. We'd love to hear from you.
Hello, I'm John Cormack, and I've been reading these books, crikey, when I think about it, 18, 19 years now. Seems like a lifetime, man and boy. Suppose favourite books. Well, Roddy Doyle comes springs to mind. All the Roddy Doyle, the Barry Town trilogy, which leap off the page and are wonderful to read. But I think one that would even surpass that is a book called The Butcher Boy by Patrick McCabe. That was his first novel, and shocked and, I must say, frightened the life out of me. And it was splendid to read.
When I was a young lad, 20 or 30 or 40 years ago, I lived in a small town where they were all after me on account of what I had done on Mrs. Nugent. I was hiding out by the river in a hole under a tangle of briars. It was a hide me and Joe made. Death to all dogs who enter here, we said. Except us, of course. You could see plenty from the inside, but no one could see you. Weeds and driftwood and everything floated downstream under the dark archway of the bridge. Sailing away to Timbuktu. Good luck now, weeds, I said. And then I stuck me nose out to see what was going on. Plink. Rain, if you don't mind. But I wasn't complaining. I liked rain. the hiss of the water, and the earth so soft bright green plants would nearly sprout beside you. This is the life, I said. I sat there, staring at a water drop on the end of a leaf. It couldn't make up its mind whether it wanted to fall or not. It didn't matter. I was in no hurry. Take your time, drop, I said. We've got all the time we want now. We've got all the time in the world.
I think it's a great service, the RNIB Talking Books. And it's also quite personal for me because my mother lost her sight in the 5 years before she died and used to get the books, which was lovely and a great comfort to her. The only slight downside with that was that she used to get my books and I used to get notes on the phone. As in, I don't like the way you did that.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
Last week, I recommended Slade House by David Mitchell as a suitably creepy read for Halloween. This week, he joined me from his home in County Cork. It's a quintet of ghost stories set about the very creepy Slade House, which only appears once every 9 years. Yeah. Could you tell us a little bit more?
That's a pretty good summary, really. There's an alleyway in a town which is not named, so it might be near you. There's an alley, Slade Alley, and you go down, and ordinarily there's no doors in this alley. You just go in one street, and it turns left, you go along a straight point in the middle, then you turn right, and then you're out on the parallel road. But, as you say, once every 9 years, if things are aligned right, then you'll find a small black iron door down there. And if you're the person for whom it is supposed to open, it will open, and you go inside. And there's surprisingly large grounds and a house that shouldn't really fit there, given what you may know of the local geography. But nonetheless, the house is there. Usually you've been invited. Usually you've heard about it or you've had an invitation and you've had directions. And you go in, and exactly what happens to you when you're in is what the book is about. But it probably isn't what you were bargaining for.
And what I love...
Happy Halloween.
What I love is that each story begins in fairly much the same way. And yeah. Just as the reader feels that they know what's going to happen, you turn the screw a little bit.
Thank you very much. And I enjoyed your smuggled in reference to Henry James's A Turn of the Screw there. Nice one. It's something many writers do, so I'm not claiming this is my unique invention, but you can use the reader's expectations as a weapon, if you like, to surprise them, to encourage them to lower their guard. And then once you've done that, you can get inside their head and turn the tables on them. I love it when authors do that to me, so I was trying to do the same with this one. It's a quintet of ghost stories, it's true. I almost think of it as five variations on the same ghost story, but ghost story is a genre, and every genre is made of sub-genres, and the ghost story is no exception. There are psychological ghost stories where you're not quite sure if the ghost is happening in the protagonist's head or not. There are historical ghost stories, more in the vein of M.R. James or someone like that. There are borderline horror ghost stories where things take a dark turn in a Stephen King kind of direction. There are what you might call ontological ghost stories, if it's okay to use a word like that at this time of day, where you simply don't know what is real. Who the ghost is. Is the ghost who you think it is? Is this poor, innocent puppet as innocent as we think? So with each of the five in Slade House, I tried to write them in a different subgenre of the ghost story. And stories and story by story, they build up a bigger kind of a cubist portrait of the house and of the world that the house is in and exactly what is going on. Does that make sense?
It does, and for readers who are very familiar with your work, it's the same world as the Bone Clocks, the novel that came before it, where there are two
rival feuding factions of immortal occultists fighting it out in the human world, using humans themselves.
Yeah, that's right. I do like to have my cake and eat it, if you like. I like to spend my writing life making as gigantic a cathedral-sized world as I possibly can. Yet also, I don't want to spend my career on a single Middle Earth or Westeros. So I also like my books to be individuals that make sense if you've read nothing else I've ever written before. So Slate House follows that pattern. I hope it works as a standalone, which is completely coherent if you read nothing else I've ever written. But if you have read other books of mine, then you'll notice a few characters, a few friends and foes creeping in from previous books.
It rewards close reading when you find the name Penhaligon popping up again and you think, oh, I remember that from a previous book. Another feature of your writing is that you seem drawn back and back to where the limits of mortality actually exist for your characters. Is that something that you feel informs your writing or drives your writing?
Middle-aged, mate, you kind of start to see the face in the mirror and say, oh, you're not so young anymore. And you start to kind of feel the creaks in your bones and you look at kids running around or hear them playing in the playground by my house. And yet you really are a different, I mean, you are human, but the similarity ends there. I think you'd have to, it would be bizarre not to think about mortality, to not consider one's death. I do, and my books are one place that I can, I guess, conduct thought experiments and have different characters with different relationships with death, including the ones in the Bone Clocks, where there's one group who are reborn 49 days after they die in body of a very sick child who then recovers from the sickness anywhere on earth, either gender, again and again and again. They don't want it, they don't know why it happens, but they can't stop it, it just goes on and on. And then there's another group who are more vampire-like, and their fuel is essentially the souls of their victims, so they're more predatory. I guess through them, I was thinking about mortality via immortality, maybe persuading myself that immortality wouldn't be such a great prospect after all, that it's actually the ends of our lives contain our humanity and give value to the finite number of days we have. Now, of course, we all hope that we have as many days as we can, and or at least healthy days where we're able to do things and have experiences which allow us to enjoy life.
And I think one area where immortality does seem to exist in your writing is the story, the narrative will outlast people's lives. It's certainly a feature in your breakthrough novel, Cloud Atlas, where actually the way in which a story is told might change and come full circle from being an oral tradition to a book and then back to an oral tradition. The world of the story seems to be, well, actually, you call it at one point an orison in Cloud Atlas, the new form of storytelling there, which is something close to religion, I believe.
Oh, there's about three things there. That was a very deep question, sir, if I may say so.
I do apologise.
Very deep indeed. We'll come back to Orison in a moment. I loved what you were saying about the idea that a narrative is a kind of a life form. If you think about King Arthur, say, not the character, but the set of stories about King Arthur. Now, they were being told, no doubt, 800-900 years ago. They're there in medieval poetry. They're there in the Gawain poet's masterwork. We don't know what that poet's name was. He just called the Gawain poet. He gets named by a character who even in his day belonged to mythology. Isn't that something? Isn't that cool? And then in the 19th century, all sorts of kind of, with the rise of nationalism and the search for a sort of an essence of Britishness, or as we might now say, Englishness, depending on what side of the border you're on. It's a body of stories. It's a body. It's a corpus. Mm. And it's great that that word is something that is infused with life. You know, we call it a body, like a living being. And it's difficult to imagine a future UK where, or a future Britain or a future England or a future Scotland or Wales, because he's there as well, where the life form that we are calling the Arthurian tales is not told. The stories of King Arthur, they live longer than the human beings who tell those stories. They'll probably outlive the artifacts, the DVDs and the books. They'll still be there at the end of the line of people who identify themselves as British. And, of course, he's all over the world as well, just because, for whatever reason, Hollywood likes him and he's an exportable thing. No doubt, well, I know different cultures have their own versions of these immortal stories. It's quite something, isn't it? Nice thought, sir, to kind of view a story as a life form. I really like that. And Orison, when you're coining neologisms, it's cool to take existing words that have heft and legacy and heritage and give them a new usage. The tech world does this. Silicon Valley does this. We have the mouse and we scroll and we click on the tab. They're all old words that get given a new, that kind of get rebooted. And, well, that's another one, isn't it? That get given a new usage and a new purpose. So when I invent a neologism, I prefer not to sort of create a portmanteau word out of thin air or a brand new word that I quite like to use an old one, like Orison, which I think is in the King James Bible. It just means a prayer. And to apply it to this new piece of tech, which is something not a million miles away from a holographic iPad. No doubt new media will, well, they are, even since I wrote Cloud Atlas, the e-book got invented, although it was conceived in science fiction in the mid to late 20th century. But it actually hit the marketplace and is somewhat in decline already. So there you go. Things are always changing.
The life forms that populate your books, your characters, I read somewhere that actually they write letters to you to express their voices. That's how you flesh them out for writing them. Which is a fascinating way of creating your characters. It's as if they've muscled their way into your consciousness.
Thank you for calling it fascinating, because it makes me feel fascinating as well, but I don't really. It just seems quite an obvious thing to do for me. You know, it's to a large part, we are our voices, at least as far as other people perceive us. We are suckers for making judgments about people on how they speak. Sometimes these judgments can be justified, and educated language user often sounds educated, but not always, not necessarily. Nonetheless, we always do it. So just when I'm bringing a character to life, when I'm thinking of who they are, especially when I'm stuck, actually, if I've hit a bit of a rut or a reef, and I find myself doing cosmetic corrections on the same scene over and over and over without moving on to any new stuff, it's usually because I don't know the characters well enough. And the way to kind of float the narrative boat off this struck reef is to just get the character to write a confidential letter to me. It's funny, it's somehow easy writing letters. It doesn't really feel like you're engaged in an act of creative art. It's just a letter. The effortlessness of that process, the ease with which you slip into that voice, outwits the block, outwits whatever it is that is getting in the way of the narrative.
I don't know if you've ever listened to the audiobook versions of your books, but actually the characters' voices come through very, very strongly. For those of us who are blind, who have to take most of our information in through what people say to us, they lift themselves out of the audiobook and seem to be speaking directly to the reader. Which I guess is why your books are so popular amongst members of the RNIB Talking Books Library.
Well, I'm very happy to hear that. I know the producers of the audiobooks. I've met them and we're in touch occasionally. They seem like a very professional outfit. Actors are remarkable people. They do what I've been saying, what I've been talking about textually, just with their voices. And that's an astonishing talent that I am in awe of, because I really don't have it. but I'm really happy that the audiobooks have given pleasure. I count myself blessed to live in an age where this can happen and where my work can have this aural dimension. So long live all of us, and long live audiobooks.
David Mitchell, thank you so much for telling us about the world of Slade House and also the Bone Clocks, and for being a guest on Read On Air.
Oh, it's really my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks to David Mitchell. All his novels are available from the RNIB Library, including Cloud Atlas, which is TB13891, The Bone Clocks, TB21531, and, if you dare, Slade House, which is TB23001. Now it's back to Gail Honeyman for the books of her life.
Thanks, Red. You're listening to Read On Air on RNIB Connect Radio. Now, for this week's Books of Your Life, I'm joined by Gail Honeyman, author of Eleanor Oliphant Is Completely Fine. Now, what we do in this section of the show, Gail, is ask authors what books they grew up with and what books they return to and what books they love and made them want to become a writer. So, we'll start in childhood. What book did you like as a child?
It's so hard to pick out just one because I was a voracious reader. We'd go to the library a ridiculous number of times a week. I think they were thoroughly sick of the sight of me. So I read very widely and I just always had my nose in a book. I really loved reading the classics, so and I still do, and I have just studied 19th century literature at university. So probably Jane Eyre is one of my favourites. A book that I enjoyed as a child and then returned to often as an adult, and in that way with books like that where you find something different in them as a child and then rereading as an adult, you're, because of your own experience has changed and you can see different things in the book. It could be any one of numerous books, but I think I would choose Jane Eyre, Charlotte Bronte.
And there's echoes of that in your book Eleanor Oliphant Is Completely Fine.
That's right, yeah. I tried to echo that sense of someone with a difficult childhood which shapes them as an adult, and tell a story so that the reader finds out how the character's childhood influenced what happens to them as an adult and how they can move on from that, hopefully, and to something more positive.
There was no possibility of taking a walk that day. We had been wandering, indeed, in the leafless shrubbery an hour in the morning. But since dinner, Mrs. Reed, when there was no company, dined early. The cold winter wind had brought with it clouds so sombre and a rain so penetrating that further outdoor exercise was now out of the question. I was glad of it. I never liked long walks, especially on chilly afternoons. Dreadful to me was the coming home in the raw twilight, with nipped fingers and toes, and a heart saddened by the chidings of Bessie, the nurse, and humbled by the consciousness of my physical inferiority to Eliza, John, and Georgiana Reed. The said Eliza, John, and Georgiana were now clustered round their mamma in the drawing-room. She lay reclined on a sofa by the fireside, and with her darlings about her, for the time being neither quarrelling nor crying, looked perfectly happy. Me she had dispensed from joining the group, saying she regretted to be under the necessity of keeping me at a distance, but that until she heard from Bessie, and could discover by her own observation that I was endeavouring, in good earnest, to acquire a more sociable and childlike disposition, a more attractive and sprightly manner, something lighter, franker, more natural, as it were, She really must exclude me from privileges intended only for contented, happy little children.
So your childhood book, you said, is also the one you would cuddle up to and return to.
Yeah, that's a bit of a cheat. Sorry to use the same one for both, but it's true.
And what about something you've read recently?
Something I read recently, I still am. Reading is a habit from childhood that's stayed with me all through my life. It's a source of enormous pleasure. So I still read very widely, a mixture of contemporary fiction, read fiction and translation, return to books that I've read before to reread. As a writer, I think I read differently now as well, because I'm reading not just for pure pleasure as a reader, but also to see what other writers have done and techniques that they use. So a book that I read recently was A Little Life by Hannah Yanagihara, I think is how her surname is pronounced, which was a completely immersive experience. I'm not sure how long it is, but it's a bit of a doorstopper. But yeah, I found it was a very immersive reading experience. I was lucky enough to have a few days off, and so I was able to, you know, I wasn't just fitting in bits here and there around other things. I was able to just sit inside that story and really immerse myself in it. And I'm not sure if enjoy is the right word, because it's a fairly harrowing tale, but I thought it was a wonderful reading experience, all told.
A Little Life by Hannah Yanagihara. The 11th apartment had only one closet, but it did have a sliding glass door that opened onto a small balcony, from which he could see a man sitting across the way, outdoors, in only a T-shirt and shorts, even though it was October, smoking. Willem held up a hand in greeting to him, but the man didn't wave back. In the bedroom, Jude was accordioning the closet door, opening and shutting it, when Willem came in. "There's only one closet," he said. "That's okay," Willem said. "I have nothing to put in it anyway."
Thanks again to Gail Honeyman. And don't forget, if you'd like to share the books of your life, why not drop us a line via the usual address, readonair@rnib.org.uk. Alas, that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to all my guests and to all of you who've been in touch about your book groups, the books you're enjoying, and recommendations for books that would expand my horizons. Read On Air will be back at the same time next week, but if you can't wait that long, why not head to our Audio Boom page? All our previous shows are there, packed with book news, reviews, and exclusive author interviews. You'll find a link at our website, rnibconnectradio.org.uk. So, until next week, thanks for listening, and remember to read on.